Listen to RN with the ABC Radio app. It's full of ideas.
Hello, Paul Barclay with you. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas here on RN Online, on Radio Australia and on the ABC Radio mobile app. There are few who can claim to having lived a life as full and varied as Peter Garrett. He's been a rock and roll singer in an internationally successful band, a senior government minister and MP, the head of one of the nation's leading conservation bodies. And at just over 60 years of age, there are no doubt further chapters still to be written. Who knows? Maybe he'll even get the band back together again.
We don't have plans to do it. We're just not saying it won't happen because we get on, and if we get in a room and if it sounds like the business, then who knows?
As the lead singer of Midnight Oil, a high-profile environmentalist with the Australian Conservation Foundation and an anti-nuclear activist, Peter Garrett was once the darling of the progressive left. Then he entered Parliament, choosing Labor over the Greens, and the rumbling started. He's sold out was to become a persistent criticism, including from Greens leader Bob Brown, a man with whom he'd shared many a platform in the past. The criticism is baseless, says the now former politician, who is unapologetic about his political career, touting a list of achievements. But as Environment Minister, Peter Garrett was dogged by fallout from the government's home insulation program, during the rollout of which four installers died on the job. The subsequent controversy was to cost him the portfolio. Also controversial has been Peter Garrett's retraction of an allegation made in his book, Big Blue Sky, that he was offered an envelope full of cash by a representative of Clubs New South Wales. That claim, and his subsequent correction of it, as well as the response by Clubs New South Wales, has all played out in the news, and Big Ideas will not be adding to this part of his story. Tonight, I'm in conversation with Peter Garrett about his passions: politics, music, the environment, and Indigenous Australia. Let's head to the powerhouse in Brisbane. We're going to plunge into politics firstly, talk about music, the environment, and everything else. You left Parliament in 2013. Along with you went Nicola Roxon, Julia Gillard, Greg Combe, Stephen Smith, Robert McClelland, Martin Ferguson, Craig Emerson, Simon Crean, and within a few months, Kevin Rudd. That is an amazing loss of talent in such a short period of time, and it must tell us something about the period that preceded it. You've had some distance now from that. What was the upshot of those two terms of Labor government? Was it an immense wasted opportunity?
I don't think so, Paul. I think that there were two things happening and they ran in parallel lines. One was this perpetual conflict writ large, seen on our television screens and listened to on radio and commented to in social media, which was about the Rudd leadership and then, of course, Julia Gillard's ascension to that position, and then Rudd's eventual comeback. And the story was taken up with glee and relish by the Canberra Press Gallery. They love nothing more than a leadership stoush, and they feed off it, and they fed it in times. And then at the same time, there was a bunch of people trying to really do what I would describe as maybe the bread and butter of politics, which is to try and get stuff done.
Policy, yeah.
The policy, the sorts of the National Disability Insurance Scheme or the Gonski Education Reforms. Things that we thought were going to be better for the country, which meant as ministers you just rolled up your sleeves and ignored all of the static that was going on behind you, turned off the television in your office and just tried to do the work.
That's what you were trying to do, but of course you must have been distracted by the fact that there was this sort of self-indulgent power struggle going on in the background. What did you make of that, seeing it all unravel at close quarters? You would know, obviously, that a disunified party, a unified party has enough trouble getting stuff through. A disunified party is really going to struggle.
Yeah, you're right. And I think the thing about it is that people have got less patience with political shenanigans. They see more of it because it's more widely broadcast. And I was a student of politics. You know, I love my politics. And I watched the Whitlam government effectively come undone in part because of lack of discipline. And so I wasn't a member of a faction. I came in late. I was a celebrity candidate, so I was an easy target at the beginning for some of the media commentary and silliness. And I felt the best thing that I could do was to try and show what I thought were the right attributes or qualities. So having done that, you're faced with one of two choices. Do you buy into it? Do you become a player and a commentator and an agitator? Or do you basically just shut the door and pull your officials in and say, look, we've got 2.5 years and we want to land a very big reform. How do we get this job done?
And were you able to do that? Were you able to sort of compartmentalise yourself and your staff and your department from it?
To some extent you could. Maybe not with junior people, but with senior people I think you could, because many of our senior bureaucrats have seen... I mean, there's an element of this which is in some ways predictable. There's always a putative leader. We saw it through the Howard era, will or won't Peter Costello challenge. But we never really saw an undermining, I don't think, on the scale that Kevin Rudd applied once Julia Gillard was chosen as the leader of the Labor Party. And so for me, it was just a case of saying, look, we've got in front of us three things which are massive. This was in the education portfolio. Needs-based school funding system, something that educationists had dreamed about for over 50 years. National standards, a national curriculum where we actually apply ourselves as a nation to figuring out how we lift the bar on education. And all the early childhood work that we were doing as well. And they, each one of them was fairly significant, required cooperation from the states. You needed to have the budgets in place and you needed to figure out how the policy worked. The really boring nuts and bolts thing that policy wonks can write books about but no one else is interested in. And that's what we used to meet at like 7 o'clock in the morning and try and figure out, and we'd still be there at 11 o'clock at night trying to get it done.
You said that Kevin Rudd was a megalomaniac, that he'd become a threat to national security, he was a poll-driven freak, he couldn't delegate, a micromanager who paralysed the business of government. I could go on with some more quotes.
It's all in the book.
Yet despite this, he was the man Labor turned to again in 2013 and they handed the prime ministership back to him. What did you make of that at the time?
Paul, I think that's just the cruel calculus of the numbers. So for a Labor backbencher who's come into the parliament perhaps in their late 30s or early 40s, they may have worked in politics before, they've committed themselves and they find themselves sitting on a margin of 3, 4, 5%. If they don't hold their seat, they're effectively in the wilderness as an individual for at least 5 to 10 years. No one will employ them, particularly if the government they're a part of loses. Their own community may turn their back on them. They've got children, perhaps, and mouths to feed. And for them, they may say something like, well, look, I think my own view is that Rudd is a total bastard, but he may get me over the line, and perhaps Julia Gillard won't.
Do you think that was the collective view of the party at that time?
I think it was the view of the backbench and some members of the caucus. What I don't think they took into account, though, was where the Australian people were ultimately going to go in respect of Julia. Because I don't think there's been any political leader in our country at that high level of office, a prime minister, who's essentially been slandered, abused, criticised and picked at for such a long period of time and yet still managed to deliver significant reform through the parliament. And I think that was a story that she had to tell. And had she had that opportunity in an election, I'm not saying she would have won. I think that would have been very difficult. But I think she would have done a lot better than people would have expected.
Whatever else can be said about Julia Gillard, it seems to me she never really developed a satisfactory narrative to explain to the public why it was necessary to overthrow a first-term Prime Minister, and she could never get over that. Do you agree?
I do, and I think in a lesser way, if I'm asked a question by you or by others as to what should I have done, particularly in the first term, it would have been explain it myself better, and she should have explained, and so should senior colleagues have explained that situation better.
To have explained how bad the government was functioning under Kevin Rudd.
Well, not only that, but I think as well explain that, look, when the Labor Party meets as a caucus, it has the sovereignty to determine who its leader is. And if it loses faith in a certain person, whether they're Prime Minister or not, I mean, you don't elect Prime Ministers. The public sort of have a view that you do, but the reality is you elect parties and the party itself elects the Prime Minister.
Can you pinpoint the time when Kevin Rudd seemed to lose the plot? Some people suggest that it was after Copenhagen. He came back a broken, disappointed man. Do you have a sense of when things really turned for him and when he got completely bogged down?
I have a sense from my own perspective, but I think the important thing about writing the book was that I didn't have this view about Rudd from the beginning. In fact, I voted for Rudd to lead the party because I thought he could beat Mr. Howard. I had a great deal of respect for Kim Beazley, but Beazley had already been beaten by Howard, and a number of us, including newbies like myself, thought that Rudd had the ambition and the hunger, if you like, to get Labor over the line. And it really wasn't until events unfolded, if you like, through the first term and then into the second term, that my views about Rudd and my opinion about him hardened. But from my perspective, it was towards the very end of a very difficult period for me as the Environment Minister who had responsibility for home insulation, the home insulation program, and had been pilloried. And obviously had been through a pretty difficult period because we did have these four kids that lost their lives. I mean, some, when you look back on it, not as a consequence of the government's program, but nevertheless, it had happened in the government's program. And yet, having gone through that and taken the advice from the department, have put in place a whole range of different safety measures, you know, weathered all the attacks in question time and censure motions and Tony Abbott calling me all manner of things, most political people in the party felt that we were through that period, but Rudd himself didn't. And essentially behaved in a way which I thought was very erratic, which was not the sort of behaviour that I attributed to consistent leadership. And for me, that was the beginnings of when he lost the plot. But there are many other examples, and they've been testified to by other senior cabinet ministers.
You believe, actually, that you were the fall guy over the insulation scheme. In fact, that's the name of the chapter in the book. Why do you believe that you should have kept your job?
Because I think that the test of whether someone's done their job properly is to identify an area where they either got something wrong, didn't accept advice, tried to hide something, misled the public. I did none of those things. I had an Australian National Audit Office, a Senate committee inquiry, I had a Royal Commission up here in Brisbane about it. And all of those came to much the same view. I wasn't told at one point. I did everything that I could. The program itself was rolled out quickly. But it was the lack of support from Rudd and his office in many ways that said to me they were prepared to hold me up as a sacrificial lamb. And from my perspective, I was prepared to be that publicly because I had responsibility for the program and I believed that you do take one for the team. But in telling the story, I felt it needed more context, and that's why I called it the fall guy.
Do you think if you had been factionally aligned that perhaps you would have been safer in your cabinet position than you ended up being?
Possibly. No, I mean, possibly. It's a difficult one to know. The fact that I wasn't factually aligned in my entire time in politics was both a blessing and a curse for me. It was a blessing because I essentially wasn't part of the various machinations of the factions, and they happen in the Liberal Party and the National Party as well. But it was a curse because I never had a Praetorian Guard that could protect me. So whenever anything was on, you didn't necessarily know where the bits and pieces were going to be falling at the end of the day.
Was it possible, too, that you were still a relatively inexperienced minister at the time? Did that play any role, do you think?
No, I don't think I was inexperienced at all. In fact, I think I was more experienced than some other ministers, and certainly experienced enough to administer that scheme. You know, I've had nothing but what I would describe as respectful, positive feedback from the people that I worked with at the time.
It must have been dreadful, though, as minister, getting up in the morning, finding out that these tragedies had occurred amongst the installers. I mean, even though you didn't believe that in any way you were personally responsible, nonetheless, it must have been a terrible time for you.
Yeah, of course it was. I mean, I was asked at the time about my regrets, and they're the same as today. Essentially believing that in a scheme of this kind, those people who had carriage over younger people that were working for them would take more care.
Lots of intention, but no understanding. If Ned Kelly was king, he'd make those robbers swing. He'd send them down. just a camera, four-wheel drive wreck.
On RN, online, or on the ABC Radio app, you're with Big Ideas. Tonight, I'm in conversation with Peter Garrett. Back to the powerhouse in Brisbane.
Now, the great thing about this conversation is that we can talk about politics and music.
We can, two of we
my
will.
Two of my favourite topics, and actually the environment, which is another topic I like to talk about. So we get real value for money. I want to talk about music, and we'll probably come back to politics a bit later as well. In your memoir, you come across as a fairly typical university student of the time. You're into live music. You're being politicised by the events of the time. You were not studying as much as perhaps you should have been. You were surfing a bit too much. Actually, can anybody surf a bit too much? I think that's a
no,
contradiction in terms.
Exactly.
All fairly standard stuff, and you joined a band, also fairly standard stuff. But at some point, this band became absolutely huge. How did this happen?
It's a great way of describing it, because if you look at the success rate of bands that are formed by students or young people anywhere between the ages of 16 and 25, they're not good. And some of you in this room may have well done it and had fun and now have other jobs. Look, I think it was a combination of happenstance, luck, synchronicity, hard work and talent. Mm. And I was lucky enough, if you like, to answer an ad once I'd been playing in a band in Canberra as a uni student for what was the foundation members of Midnight Oil, Rob Hurst and Jim Magini and Andrew James, who played together at school. And they were lucky enough to get me. Well, someone who was had the front to go out and say, look, what we've got might not be to everybody's taste. And, of course, it's so interesting because you may forget, and I don't, that we weren't popular, that no one did want to listen to us, that very few radio stations, with the exception of community radio and others, would play us, that we couldn't get a recording contract, that everything that we were on about was considered too hard, too political, too whatever. And, of course, those are the foundation experiences, the formative experiences for you when you're young. So my time as a musician, which is successful, which you're referring to, for me is actually a very small part of the story. The big part of the story is how did we get there? And I think we were lucky to find a common meeting place in music that we loved, respect for one another as musicians, leaving the ego outside in the dressing room, and just sticking at it until something happened.
My favourite Midnight Oil album, as I told you earlier, is Place Without a Postcard, your second album.
Third
album, Head Injuries.
Blue album, the first one.
Of course, Head Injuries was the second album. Okay.
Sorry, Paul.
Corrected. Hang
it's
my head in shame.
It's not often you get one over a radio national broadcaster. It's only because it's my oeuvre.
But I think I'm correct in saying that Place Without a Postcard was produced by Glyn Johns.
Correct.
The legendary producer who'd produced The Stones, The Beatles, worked with The Clash, Led Zeppelin, The Who, Dylan, you name it. You must have really felt like you'd made it when you got him on as producer.
Yeah, we did. We thought this was it. We'd arrived. And when we got to his studio in the countryside in Sussex in England, and I love Glyn a lot, and I've been in touch with him lately, but he'd lost interest, really, in spending a lot of time in the recording studio. So we were a bit bewildered. We were a young Aussie band with no money, sort of sleeping in the stables and the sort of quarters that he'd produced there, going into the studio, and occasionally Glyn would turn up and sort of, you know, hit record in the studio. But he had fantastic experience. And for me, Place Without a Postcard is also one of my favourite Oils albums, because in some ways I probably did a bit better out of it than the rest of the Oils. Because he gave
How so?
Well, I got a chance to write quite a bit with Postcard.
Yep.
But also, for a singer, and I say to people, think about sound as a painting. When you look at a painting, you look to the centre of the painting, what's the sort of core subject matter in that painting? The background, the palette, what's on the palette is the backing tracks, if you like. It's the bass and drums. The guitars are the flourishes, or perhaps keyboards. But it really is the voice and the song that sits at the centre of a painting when you look at it. And it should be the same when you listen to it. So you need some air and some space around the vocal. And Glyn was extremely experienced at his craft. And, of course, he gave me that bit of air. The other thing, quickly, was that he was off in London with his mates doing whatever. And we snuck into his own studio, his little private studio upstairs, and listened to all the outtakes of the Stones and the Beatles. And that was a lot of fun.
That would have been fun. That would have been fun. Having said that it was and is still my favourite Oils album, it is also the album after which you were virtually bankrupt. And really, it took the next album 1-800-798-765-4321 to really launch you to the next level. Now, we were talking about this backstage. By the time that album came out, 10 to 1, you know, you had really built a reputation for your live acts. You were getting a lot more attention. But 10 to 1 is also a much more political album, overtly political album, lyrics-wise, than the previous album. And I was just speculating with you why it was that that was the breakthrough album. Was it because it was more a political album, or actually is that not the reason at all?
No, I don't think it is the reason. I think that we finished Postcard and we were very proud of it and we played it to the record company and they didn't want to put it out. So we came back to Australia, not so much with our tails between our legs, because we knew that we'd done the best that we could, but with a sense that, well, we've done this, what do we need to do next? And it was really, I think, a combination of some of the songs on 10 to 1, which were big, accessible songs, and I think Rob Hurst, the drummer, and Jim Magini, guitarist, both very fine songwriters, really kind of lifted themselves and came into their own as songwriters. And we met a very talented young Australian engineer who happened to be working in the UK called Nick Launay, who really had an idea that maybe Midnight Oil doesn't stand in a studio and do the Midnight Oil thing, flat chat, but rather we figure out how to use this bit of technology and get the best out of the music that we had. Now, yes, it was political, and we were really focused on things like the nuclear arms race in particular, but I think it was the combination of personality, music and studio, figuring out how to make this thing really sing and use the technology to serve our ends that made the record what it was.
We should remind people, this is the album that had Short Memories on it, US Forces, Maralinga.
Power and Passion.
Yeah, a lot of the sort of, I suppose in a sense, the beginning of those songs that began to symbolise what Midnight Oil stood for, a fiercely political band, although I know that you would think the band stood for a lot more than that, but in the eyes of many. And one of the things that it's always bemused me about the Oils is that many of the people who came to see you live and were really into you didn't necessarily share your politics, did they? They loved the energy, the rock and roll energy of the gigs, but they weren't necessarily buying into the messages that you were singing about.
No, but you know, Paul, I think the thing about this is that Midnight Oil wasn't a message machine, it was a rock band. And the messages, in a way, or the lyrics were a part of what we did, but we didn't sit down, and I've said it a couple of times before, but we just didn't sit down as a bunch of sort of student political science graduates and say, well, we must write a song about X. So I think that one of the reasons that 10 to 1 worked for us and subsequent albums was despite the politics, particularly here in Australia, because we just figured out how to get a better sound out of our recording processes and we got better at what we were doing, which is what happens to all of us if we keep plugging away. And I think the other thing is that the mood of the times, particularly in Europe and North America, was considerably heightened by the thought that we'd keep on manufacturing nuclear weapons, were they going to be used or not. There were build-ups in Europe and the like. And we were probably one of the first bands that actually articulated that in some way. Mm. Now, for us, it was just kind of a natural thing to do. It was like writing about the Sunshine Coast, but it ended up touching a chord with people in other parts of the world.
The occupational hazard of rock and roll is obviously drink and drugs. You were part of the pub rock scene in Australia, and many of your contemporaries, unfortunately, got very much hooked up into some very bad habits. But by and large, the Oils steered clear of that. How did you manage that? What was it about this band that was as much a part of pub rock as, say, Cold Chisel that meant that you didn't succumb to that?
Well, I don't think we were little angels running around the place sort of drinking water backstage.
No, we do get a bit of a sense of that. Yeah. There was the occasional joint and so on going down, but you were fairly contained.
Yeah, well,
unless you want to confess.
Tonight in Brisbane, that television did go out the window. No, look, it was a real struggle for us as a band. A lot of what we were doing and what we were saying and the way we were organising ourselves was different to the way other bands approached and worked in the entertainment.
You were a collective, really, weren't you?
We were a collective. Gary Morris, who managed us, was a member of the band. We did just about as much of it as we could ourselves. And we weren't prepared to take a backward step in terms of organising our affairs. And once we became a band that toured internationally, I mean, it sounds pretty lame, but there really wasn't any time for sitting around and doing that stuff. I mean, if you're serious about your career and you're building something internationally, you need to take care of yourself. And I think underneath all of that was for me, and this is what I reflected on when I wrote the memoir, what was it that sort of really made me stay in this place as a musician for so long when I had a big passion for politics? And it's really the fact that when you listen to or when you were on a stage where the Alls were playing, there was nothing like it on earth. And it in itself had the power and the majesty and the grunt and the sort of tenaciousness to just keep me going and to keep my spine tingling.
That leads me to the question that I was going to ask, that there comes a time when you decide that you're not going to do that anymore. There is nothing in life, as I'm sure you can attest, and I don't know this because I've never experienced it, but the adrenaline of being out there in front of thousands, tens of thousands of people sometimes, performing, that must be incredible. How did you stop doing it?
Well, I love performing, but I used to switch off my brain to do it. No, really, and yeah. I think, you know, I used to sort of think to myself, if I can get in the zone and I've got the Alls around me and there are these songs that we've written and there's a bunch of other people out there who want to be a part of it, all I've got to do is almost channel that thing as much as I can and not think about it, not be at all self-conscious or analytical about it at all, whether it's the dancing or whatever it might be. And I think that moment was so precious for me, and I felt it was so precious for the audience. And every night we got up on stage, we used to spill our guts and do as much as we could and fall over and nearly kill ourselves and then get up the next day and do it. But I never thought about it. I never spent any time analysing. I didn't read the reviews. I didn't listen to what thoughtful, smart people had to say about it, because that's not how I was responding. It was visceral. It was physical. It was on an emotional plane. And I considered myself to be the luckiest man on earth to be out there in front of people. I think when Midnight Oil made its decision that it wasn't going to move overseas, that we weren't going to continue to climb the ladder, we weren't going to come follow U2 and REM, which is what the industry expected us to do, because we really knew that our umbilical cord was connected to the red earth and the coastline and the families and the suburbs we'd grown up in Australia. I want to hear magpies or currawongs in the morning. Mm. You know, I can't really get going until I've done that. Yeah. So that put us in a kind of holding pattern, which was fine. But for me as an activist, it wasn't enough to hold me.
So you had to give something up in order to switch the other side on, to become a more cerebral, more engaged person. That necessarily meant that you couldn't do what you'd loved doing. There's sort of a duality there, really, isn't there? You can't be both.
No, you can't. And at one point I was torn, if you like, and I think the band and the audience had been quite tolerant of me, and certainly when I was ACF president, my wife had as well, spending a lot of time away and really essentially doing two kinds of things at the one time. I was writing less, I was contributing less as a musician in the band, and I was spending more time in the outside world, in the non-government organisation world, and at some point something had to give, and I knew that the time would come when I would make that decision. And it wasn't out of any animosity or lack of respect for my colleagues, far from it actually, it was the other way around. I waited so long because I couldn't have thought of doing it.
People may have forgotten this, but back in the 80s, when Midnight Oil was huge, you were very nearly voted in as a senator for the Nuclear Disarmament Party. Yeah. Your profile with the band was used to maximise the vote of the NDP, fair enough. It was a cause you felt passionate about, and to focus attention on disarmament and ending war. This was a very interesting time, but what on earth would have happened to the Oils if you had been elected? And I get the feeling that was never really part of the plan, actually being elected to the Senate, and you damn near were, nearly were.
Well, I tried hard, and look, we never sat down really and spent a lot of time thinking about it, other than to say, if you get in, you go, you do the best that you can, and we'll figure out whether we can continue to play and write and record, and whether you've got a role with us to do that. And you're right, I mean, I got way more votes than Clive Palmer's people in the Senate have ever got, which is not saying a lot, I guess, but and I came very close. But at the same time, the point that I wanted to make had been made.
Yeah.
You probably are right in suggesting, Paul, that there was a collective sigh of relief when we realised that we had more opportunities to play and record.
And a sigh of relief from yourself as well? Or would you have been open, you know, at that younger time in your life for entering politics?
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I would have gone for it, you know, roaring tooth and claw.
Peter Garrett, former politician, singer and activist on Big Ideas on RN Online and on the ABC Radio mobile app. As he reminds us in his memoir Big Blue Sky, it was Mark Latham who effectively recruited Peter Garrett into politics.
I was attracted to Latham when he became leader, and I thought he had a powerful sort of intelligence, and he was dogged, and he was turning Howard around a little bit in the parliament. And he went out to meetings like this and took questions from the floor and basically took on all comers to argue the Labor cause. And in some ways, Latham was from effectively the electorate of Werriwa, so he was an acolyte of Whitlam's at one point, although they did fall out. I was a big Gough Whitlam admirer, and even though I'd had discussions with the Greens and Bob Brown and others about potentially being a Green, effectively and essentially my own, beneath the sort of radar and beneath in my gut inclination, was to be a Labor politician because of the history and the values of the party as I'd seen writ large since Federation.
Well, let's just talk about what you said, what you've written about the Greens in the book. I think it's interesting, and you'll be aware that at the time you joined Labor, many of your fans did and would have assumed that actually you would join the Greens. You chose not to. And you write that Bob Brown approached you to join the Greens, and you say, "I was too much of an economic dry and too allergic to utopianism to join the Greens. I couldn't envisage years of playing a dishonest song to the bleachers, promising a nirvana that couldn't be delivered." That's how you see the Greens.
It's how they've delivered their narrative, particularly in the federal parliament. Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that for me, which is not to say that some of the issues that are implied or explicit in that narrative aren't important. I mean, a good example would be treatment of refugees, and I think Hanson Young's done a very good job. But if you're looking for the concrete solutions in policy terms around environment issues, which I was fully committed to and probably knew a fair bit about, and you wanted to see them delivered, I didn't believe that that would happen through the Greens. But more to the point, Paul, I'm not a utopianist. I don't believe that someone can stand up and say, let me rephrase it another way. Someone who's lost faith in the future, as someone wrote, shouldn't spend all their time criticising the present. Because sometimes progress is messy and it involves compromise, and sometimes it's incremental. And I'm also an economic dry in the sense that I'd finally, in Midnight Oil, been in a business. We'd employed people, we'd paid taxes. It sounds like the small business person's mantra. And you know what? It is. That is how we fund the ABC. That is how we build roads and have schools and hospitals and all those sorts of things. You can't do it unless people are actually generating something. And the default position that I saw in Greens policy was always about, we will default to government, which must get something wrong because we know they're hopeless and horrible, and spend more money and change their mind about this issue. And it was far too simplistic an analysis.
Well, I spoke to Lindsay Tanner about this, and the way he put it was that the Greens have the advantage of standing no chance of ever forming government. That means that they can outbid Labor on every progressive cause that you care to mention. They can outbid you on refugees, on climate change, on environment policy. And they've been adept at that to the point where they've increased their vote, but also to the point where they put the kibosh on your emissions trading scheme.
Yes, which was a terrible decision on their part, and one which I think ought to be recognised as very, very bad politics. It may have had the effect of them feeling better about not having a perfect scheme, but it set us back years. It saw Tony Abbott come into the leader of the opposition at the time, and then ultimately Prime Minister. And of course, the effect of that was for him to dismantle all of the positive climate change measures that were in place. But there's more to it than that. It was cynical politics, and the Greens had a great narrative going about the fact that all politicians are hopeless, and the cynicism, they played to the cynicism of the electorate about politicians, but then they were very cynical themselves. Now, they weren't the only ones to blame. Rudd was to blame as well, because he was essentially pushing Malcolm Turnbull and trying to extract political damage on Turnbull. Bob and Christine Milne were trying to extract political damage on Rudd, and the consequence was that we lost that scheme, and it wasn't until some years later under Julia Gillard and with Greg Conbay as minister that it came back in another form.
How's your relationship with Bob Brown these days, by the way? Did that suffer a wedge being put? The two of you were very close. You were on the same sort of platform back in the 80s when you were environmental campaigners and activists. How do you get on now?
Look, I think Bob and I get on fine. I think Bob was a very skillful politician. And a lot of people confuse conservation organisations with the Greens. I find it hard to see a single initiative that the Greens put forward or achieved in environment in over 10 years that I was in the Parliament. I can't think of any. I'm happy to hear from somebody if they can. At the same time, I think Bob was an outstanding campaigner who had an incredible empathy both with nature and with people's response to nature. And I dare say in the future, if there was a big environment campaign that we both felt strongly about, we could work together again on it.
He did say that you'd sold out, though, didn't he?
It was a convenient slogan for him. In actual fact, I joined in. I was always a team player. I was a team player in Midnight Oil, and I became a team player in the Labor Party, and I exercised the disciplines that I thought a member of the Labor Party should exercise.
It seems to me that you're saying that modern mainstream politics is about pragmatism and incrementalism. But is incrementalism enough to deal with a problem as substantial as climate change? Kiribati, just, you know, over the road there, is going underwater. Yeah. They want something much more substantial than just incremental policy. They would like perhaps something like a ban on more coal mines in Australia. How do you reconcile what your perception of what is achievable is with what's needed on such an urgent issue as this?
That is such a useful and good question, and my answer is going to be quite complex because I think there's different parts to this issue. In other words, what seems incremental to the people of Kiribati seems like the end of the economy to some of our major industries and our major industry associations. What's possible for us to do as a nation is different from what we require other nations to do at the same time. So I don't think it's an either-or proposition, incrementalism and the big historic step forward. I think you need it both. You've got to start the incremental work because you're reconfiguring the economy. It's not something you can do with a stroke of a pen overnight because people's employment and their livelihoods are at stake. You need to do it step by step. At the same time, you need to be bold and recognise that this is a historic moment. And if you step out, perhaps others will step out with you. So I felt that we had in place, when we went into the 2007 election, both in renewable energy, in energy efficiency, and in the carbon pollution reduction scheme, the beginnings of policy which was not incremental, but was building block policy. What did we need to make it work? Political consent by the Australian public and an international agreement to make it stick, i.e. Kyoto, Copenhagen. Now, the latter we didn't get, and we never got to test the former.
We haven't spoken actually about your connection to Indigenous Australia, and this is a connection really that runs through your career in music, in environmental activism and in politics, your love of the country, whether it's the Western Desert or whether it's Arnhem Land, you're deeply connected to this country and deeply connected to the Indigenous culture that runs through Australia and has done for thousands of years. Do you feel like any progress is being made towards closing the gap and also more generally towards dealing with the unfinished business of reconciliation?
Well, I think that up until the Adam Goods exercise where we saw Adam booed by crowds at the AFL, I would have said that we're making faltering progress towards unfinished business, and I do still think that. I think that's, in a sense, a last gasp. On the earlier question, we're succeeding in some areas of closing the gap, but they are few. It's infant mortality and skills attainment, effectively. Maternal health is not bad, and we're seeing more Aboriginal kids come into preschool than before, but not enough. But there's still big gaps on some of the other measures.
Gee, it's slow progress, isn't it?
It's very slow progress. But I guess I caution against trying to see this as something where we're failing, rather than seeing it as something where we need to learn from our mistakes and do better. And you're absolutely right. When I first left school, I hadn't met an Aboriginal person. I mean, my brother's here, and he and I went to a school on the North Shore of Sydney, and we wouldn't have seen an Aboriginal person until the ages of 18 or 19. Now I count Aboriginal people amongst my close friends, and I think there's three things that we need to do as a nation on this, and I'm prepared to say this as an ex-poly and someone who cares about this issue. We need to agree to finish the business. Mm. To recognise Aboriginal people as the first Australians, we need to get the constitutional reform right. And we need to develop a bipartisan position about programs and governance, which involves consultation with Aboriginal people on the ground from the get-go, not launching a program from Canberra or Brisbane or Sydney or wherever. And finally, and it might sound silly to everybody, but you know what? We just need to keep the programs going. Refine them, review them, improve them, but don't do all this stop-start change, which is very difficult for small and vulnerable communities to deal with and actually sees the burnout with activists and leaders that is one of the features of Aboriginal issues in Australia.
You've been a public figure in Australian life for more than 30 years or so. A rock and roll singer, a politician, an activist. You're easily one of the most instantly recognisable people in the country. When you walk into a room, everybody knows who you are. Yet you're also a very private person as well. And I was struck when I was reading the book, for example, of the photographs of your wife and your three daughters and how rarely we see photographs of them. You're very protective of them for good reason. How have you dealt with being a private person in the public spotlight?
Fine. I mean, I enjoy being with people. And, you know, I'm in the Sinatra camp, you know, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. So that's fine. I think the only thing is the separation between the public you and the private you, for me, was my family. And I have three daughters, and they're grown up now. They're in their 20s. And in their early years at primary school and high school, I didn't want them to essentially have my shadow looming over them in whatever way. I mean, there's some parts of it are unavoidable, but other parts, you're right, we tried to keep the private life very much private. The other thing is that I think we live, you know, we're in the big me generation, you know. Hey, I take selfies, so I'm not criticising anybody that does, but we're very self-obsessed. And I'm not that self-obsessed. I mean, of course I care about myself. I've got self-esteem and, you know, whatever. But I'm interested in politics and issues.
Yeah.
You know, I'm that kind of person. And so my focus has always been on those things. So I have... And Midnight Oil wasn't interested in success either. You know, we were interested in trying to make songs work. So it sounds a little disjunctive, but, you know, suddenly you're popular and you're visible and you're on TV, but it's not actually where you expect it to be. And it's a byproduct of what you were doing. So you take it as it comes.
I mean, people read memoirs in part to gain a better understanding of the person that has written the book. And during the course of writing this memoir, you say that you came up against one giant stumbling block. I was debating about whether to even bring it up, but I'll bring it up. This is around the death of your mother. You've written about it. The thought of revisiting it filled me with dread, you write. You spend only two or three pages out of over 400 talking about it, yet it is the most disturbing thing. Your mother died in a house fire. You were in the house at the time. You were unable to save her. You had to come out and watch the house burn down. I get the feeling that you're not the sort of person who dwells on this sort of stuff, and you say in the book that you certainly don't want to parade your misery. How did you get over that, though? And how much did that event, that moment, fuel who you became, the determination, the focus that you would take on to later life?
Well, I think the loss of your mum in those circumstances is obviously pretty traumatic, and my brothers and I really just had to group together and sort of see out the grief period. You're right, I didn't want to either fall into the slough of despair nor constantly parade that as something which had happened to me and, you know, poor fellow me. So I really just tried to take from her life what I thought were the positives, and she was a very vibrant, very positive sort of a person who loved life. So I took that away from it. And in writing about it, I wrote about it in part because it was a part of who I was.
Yep.
Interestingly enough, it's the only part of the book that didn't receive any editing at all. And I think that's partly because I just got up one morning and I just thought, I've just got to write it. I'm not going to think about it. However it comes out is what it is.
Surprise me that it didn't have any editing, actually. There's something very heartfelt about that section in the book. It's actually, you're taking us somewhere in that two or three pages that you don't take us in the rest of the book. in a way.
That's probably true, yeah. And look, of course it had an impact on me, but I can't really analyse what that impact was. I guess the thing I can say about it is that many people experience grief and loss in different times of their life, and they may be well supported, they may feel terribly alone. I think we supported one another, but we also felt alone. And yet at the same time, it's a very strong message to you about how precious each day is.
Mm.
And so you basically go out the next day and try and make the most of it, and that's what I've done ever since.
The circumstances, though, were so terrible. Did that make it harder?
I can't really say whether it did or didn't. I mean, what is it for some of my friends now? I mean, I'm in my 60s, and I've got friends that are watching their parents who are elderly and who are just sort of living half-lives in nursing homes, and they go and talk to the person, they've got dementia, and you know, they don't think, they can't recognise their own kids. I mean, it's not something that I think you can be comparative or generalise about. Each situation that you face with the loss of a family member is intensely personal. It's your own situation. You respond to it, you draw on what you have, and in my case, the memory of it isn't something that goes away, but I didn't want it to become a handcuff that would stop me holding out my hands.
Peter Garrett, on RN Online or on the ABC Radio app, you're with Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Back to the powerhouse in Brisbane.
It's such a full life that you've lived, and I've tried to present a bit of a cross-section of it. The one thing I suppose we haven't spoken about is your time as president of the Australian Conservation Foundation, I think at the time pretty much the largest environment organisation in the country. This was the time when Philip Toyne headed the organisation. Environmental awareness went through the roof in that period. Some say, in fact, that the decision by the Australian Conservation Foundation to advocate a vote for Labor during that period in the late 80s, and I think maybe in 1990, actually helped push Labor over the line, gave environment groups like the ACF huge leverage on issues of the environment. It was a heady time, wasn't it, for the environment movement, and a time of immense optimism.
Look, it was, and I mean, I think in some ways it was the high watermark of natural conservation, nature conservation with the environment. Before that period of time, the Antarctic was really up for grabs. We had big disputes up and down the coast around forest use. The Daintree Rainforest here in Queensland, the Great Barrier Reef, had started to be protected by Fraser, but not really.
We'd come off the back of the victory over the Franklin Dam, though, in Tasmania, which fueled that generation environmental activists.
Yeah. And then we had the historic joining up of conservationists and farmers with land care. Shelburne Bay was protected. And there are many other achievements from that time. And it was an extremely rich period, which I think had two or three things in place, which we haven't had since, except perhaps for a brief period in the first term of the Rudd government. And that is, we had a strong part of the community that was willing to stand up and say, we want to protect our precious environment, and we're prepared to go out onto the streets and lobby and be active and have our voices raised. We had scientists and researchers saying, look, this is something we need to do. If we don't do this, we're going to see damage. And by the way, it might even be good for the economy. It'll certainly be good for the community. And then, as you say, Paul, we had a Labor government under Bob Hawke who was listening carefully to what environmentalists were saying and who arguably were pushed into government by the votes of conservation-minded people. Mm. Incidentally, something which I did not support the ACF doing at the time.
Advocating a vote for Labor.
Correct.
Yeah, because it did very much put you in their corner and in the longer term, arguably reduced their potency as a lobby group.
Yes, it's one of these. And look, I think historians and conservationists will argue this till the cows come home. We got great conservation wins. I think we would have got some of those anyway, but perhaps not to the extent that we did. But of course, once Mr. Howard was elected, the doors were closed and you could bang against them as loud as you liked, but they weren't going to open.
Someone told me, actually, that such was your influence at the time as an environmentalist that and that you're in and out of Graham Richardson's office that you were one of the only people allowed into Paul Keating's office without a suit. But basically bent the rules for you.
Well, I think that's true. Look, I think it was a case of going into these offices and arguing very strongly for Australia's conservation and natural heritage. And I didn't ever feel as though we were intruders. I felt that the ACF was an organisation which had a big grassroots membership, and we were really representing the community interest. And at the same time, we had an enormous amount of worldwide awareness, the Amazon rainforest, the Rio conference, which took place around about that time, and increasing awareness amongst young Australians in particular, but many others as well, that the fabric of the country was being pulled apart bit by bit, and we needed to stand up if we were going to do something about it. And I respected and enjoyed the relationship I had with both Prime Minister Hawke and Prime Minister Keating, but it was a respectful relationship. We didn't always see eye to eye, we didn't always agree, but we did get a lot done.
Earlier in the day, I was checking out President Obama's Spotify playlists for last summer. Wow. Oh, they were very impressive, actually, for someone who's president. You should check it out. So I thought I'd ask you, what are you listening to at the moment?
I like Indigenous rappers. Mm-hmm. So people like Trials and Briggs.
Yep.
I like hip-hop generally. So The Herd is another band that I like, and there are others. I'm listening to a little bit of the new music that's coming through, but I might hear someone like Tame Impala or whoever it might be. But I'm also, Paul, like...
listening to a lot of the old stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, join the club.
Well, exactly. And before I came up, I thought, what am I going to play? I was at home and I thought, what am I going to play? And so I've got a bunch of blues things there. I've got all of my mates, the Hunters and Collectors, Chisel, Dragon, all those people. And then I just thought, it's got to be Wish You Were Here, hasn't it? You know, it's just the way it starts and the amount of time and effort that they took to really what was the first side of that album in the old days still does it for me.
Oh, look, I could talk about music all night. I was watching the Keith Richards documentary on Netflix the other night, and there is a scene where the Stones are playing with Muddy Waters in Buddy Guy's Club Chicago.
I know this scene.
In the early 80s, singing Mannish Boy.
Absolutely.
And I thought about you because I just read in your book the day before that one of the first gigs that you saw, still one of the standout gigs of all time for you, was Muddy Waters.
Absolutely, and the fact that I got to see him and I was, you know, closer than what we are to people sitting here in this auditorium. And it really said something to me in a way which wasn't intellectual. Muddy just played the blues. They just felt it on stage. And it was such a privilege. It was so rich. It was so incredibly... It just moved me beyond words. And I loved it ever since. And I loved it when we toured in the States. You know, we'd tour in the States. If we had a night off, we'd go and listen to bands. And we wouldn't go and listen to, you know, White Bread.
Yep.
We'd go and listen to these guys churning it out.
A final question. You're writing songs again, I hear.
Surprisingly, yeah, and excited, really, for me, because I stopped writing probably pretty early. And look, I'm not a prolific or a gifted songwriter at all. I can get a few words down here and there, and I love music, but I'd always been quite busy with the business of Midnight Oil, the issues that we're involved in, and then, of course, environmental activism, and I had guys around me who were so good at it. I sort of almost didn't need to, but at the end of the day of writing, I found that once I'd sort of poured my life out onto the page, something else was calling me from the corner. And look, very low-key, nothing spectacular about it. I'm not sort of trying to put it up in stars or lights, but it's been fun to finally find the music coming back.
I'm a rolling stone. Peter Garrett, former politician and lead singer with Midnight Oil. His memoir, Big Blue Sky, is published by Allen and Unwin. Thanks to the Powerhouse in Brisbane. That's the program for tonight. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
On the moon. First dog on the moon.
Morning, Moneypenny. You've changed, Moneypenny. Is he in?
Good morning, WN. Have you brought the guide to modern living?
Here you are, sir.
First dog on the moon's guide to modern living. Stream or download it at the RN website.
Put them in the van.
Oh, not again! Stop it!